Passepartout was staggered by the news. To have missed the steamship by 45 minutes crushed him. It was his fault, entirely his, since instead of helping his master, he had done nothing but place obstacles in the way. Mr. Fogg did not reproach him. As they left the transatlantic liner pier, he merely said, "We'll see about it tomorrow. Come along." Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Oudah, Fix, and Passepartout crossed the Hudson on the ferry and got a hackney cab to the St. Nicholas Hotel on Broadway. The following day was the 12th of December. Mr. Fogg left the hotel alone. He headed for the banks of the Hudson and searched for ships that were leaving. Several ships had their departure burgees displayed, but most were sailing ships that couldn't satisfy Mr. Fogg's needs. He seemed about to fail in his last attempt, when he noticed a screw-driven merchantman with elegant lines. Her funnel, sending out large whirls of smoke, showed that she was preparing to get underway. Phileas Fogg hailed a small boat, and a few oar strokes later was climbing up the Henrietta's ladder. She was a steamer with an iron hull, and upper works made entirely of wood. Her captain was about 50 years old. Large eyes, a complexion of oxidized copper, red hair, and a bull neck. Captain?
Yes.
I am Phileas Fogg.
And I am Andrew Speedy.
You're leaving?
In an hour's time.
Where are you heading?
Bordeaux.
And your cargo?
Stones in the belly. No freight. I'm traveling ballasted.
Do you have any passengers?
Never passengers. Merchandise that takes up room and argues.
Is your ship a fast one? Fogg asked.
11 to 12 knots.
Can you transport me to Liverpool with three other people?
No.
No?
I'm heading for Bordeaux. And Bordeaux is where I'm heading for.
Well, could you take us to Bordeaux?
Not even if you paid me $200.
I'm offering you 2,000.
Per person?
Per person.
And there are four of you?
Four. An hour later, the steamer Henrietta put out to sea and headed rapidly eastwards. At midday the following day, the 13th of December, a man went up on the bridge to take the bearings. It was Phileas Fogg. As for Captain Andrew Speedy, he had quite simply been locked up in his cabin. What had happened was simple enough. In the 30 hours he had been on board, Phileas Fogg had so cleverly manoeuvred with his banknotes that the crew were entirely his. And that was how he came to be in command. And that was why the Henrietta was now heading for Liverpool. For the first few days, the navigation proceeded under excellent conditions. The sea was not too difficult. The favourable wind seemed settled. The sails had been hoisted, and under its trysails, the Henrietta moved like a real transatlantic liner. Passepartout was delighted. The crew had never seen a more cheerful or active fellow. Fix no longer understood anything. The Henrietta taken by force, the bribing of its crew, Fogg manoeuvring like a born sailor, all this bewildered him. But after all, a gentleman who had begun by purloining £55,000 could easily end up stealing a ship. As for Mrs. Oudah, her loyalty to Mr. Fogg was unswerving. On the 13th, the tail end of the Great Banks of Newfoundland was passed. These are dangerous waters. In the winter, especially, there are very frequent fogs, and the storms are formidable. The barometer had gone down abruptly, and it was now giving warning of an impending change in the atmosphere. And indeed, the temperature changed during the night. The cold became sharper, and at the same time, the wind turned against the Henrietta. Passepartout's face clouded with the sky, and for 2 days the worthy fellow was on terrible tenterhooks. But Phileas Fogg was a bold mariner, able to stand up to the sea, and he stuck to his course. When the Henrietta wasn't able to rise to the waves, she cut through them, and her deck was swept right across. But she passed through all the same. By the 16th of December, approximately half the Atlantic crossing had been completed, and the most dangerous waters were behind. That day, the chief engineer approached Mr. Fogg and discussed something with him quite urgently. Without knowing exactly why, Passepartout felt worried. He would have given one of his ears to hear, with the other, what was being said. Nevertheless, he was able to catch a few phrases. "Are you sure of what you're saying?" said Mr. Fogg. "I'm sure, sir. Don't forget that we've been burning all our furnaces since we left. We had enough coal to get us from New York to Bordeaux at low steam, but we haven't got enough to get to Liverpool at full steam. I'll think it over." Fogg sent for the engineer that very evening. "Heap up the fires and carry on until there's no fuel left." So the ship continued to move forward at full steam. But on the 18th, the chief engineer said the coal would run out at some point during the day. "Don't let the fires die down," ordered Phileas Fogg. "On the contrary, the valves must be kept filled." At midday he took a bearing, then sent Passepartout on an errand. A few minutes later, a bomb arrived on the poop deck amid shouts and swear words and escorted by the Frenchman. The bomb was Captain Speedy. It was clear that he was soon going to explode.
"Where the hell are we?"
he demanded. 770 miles from Liverpool," replied Mr. Fogg, with imperturbable calm.
"Pirate?"
"I sent for you, sir."
"Buccaneer?"
"To ask you to sell me your ship."
"No, by all the devils, no!"
"Because I am going to be obliged to burn it."
"Burn my ship?"
"At least it's upper works, since we are running out of fuel."
"Burn my ship?"
bellowed Captain Speedy.
"A ship worth $50,000?
"Here's $60,000, said Phileas Fogg, offering the captain a wad of notes. No American can look at $60,000 and remain entirely unmoved. In a flash, the captain forgot all his grievances.
"The iron hull remains mine, of course,"
he said in a remarkably softened tone of voice. "The iron hull and the boiler," said Mr. Fogg. "Agreed?"
"Agreed."
Andrew Speedy grabbed the wad of notes, checked it, and thrust it into his pocket. "So this ship now belongs to me?"
"Certainly. From the keel to the masthead. At least everything that's made of wood."
"Good. Have the interior fittings demolished and stoke with the result." That day, the poop, the deckhouse, the cabins, the crew's quarters, and the orlop deck all disappeared. The following day, the spars were burnt, together with the spare masts and yards. The next day, the rails, bulwarks, deadworks, and most of the deck were devoured. The Henrietta was now raised, and no more than a pontoon. But that day, the Irish coast had been sighted. At 10 p.m., the ship was off Queenstown. Phileas Fogg had only 24 hours to reach London, but that was the time needed by the Henrietta to reach Liverpool, even at full steam. And steam was finally going to run out for the intrepid gentleman. "Can we get into Queenstown Harbour?" Mr. Fogg asked Captain Speedy.
"Not for 3 hours. Only at full tide."
"We'll wait," Fogg said calmly. Queenstown is the port where the liners coming from the United States drop their mailbags off on their way past. The mail is taken to Dublin by express trains, always ready to leave. From Dublin, it travels to Liverpool on high-speed steamers, thus beating the fastest ships by 12 hours. These 12 hours saved by the post from America, Phileas Fogg wanted to save as well. Instead of reaching Liverpool the following evening, he would arrive at midday, and so could be in London by 8:45 p.m. At about 1 a.m., the Henrietta entered Queenstown Harbour on the high tide. Mr. Fogg, Owder, Passepartout and Fix got off, and boarded a train at 1:30 a.m. They arrived in Dublin as day broke, and immediately embarked on one of those high-speed steamers. At 20 minutes to midday on the 21st of December, Phileas Fogg landed at Liverpool docks. He was 6 hours from London. At this moment, Inspector Fix put a hand on his shoulder and showed him his warrant.
Is your name Phileas Fogg?
It is.
In a Queen's name, I arrest you.
Phileas Fogg had been locked up in the custom house in Liverpool, where he would have to spend the night until his transfer to London. During the arrest, Passepartout had wanted to throw himself on the detective. Policemen held him back. Mrs. Oudah was horrified by the brutality of the proceedings, as she knew nothing about the background and could not begin to understand the situation. Now they sat together under the portico of the custom house. As for Inspector Fix, he had arrested Mr. Fogg because he was convinced that he was the gentleman thief who had robbed the Bank of England of £55,000 three days before setting off on his tour of the world. Whether Fogg was guilty or not, the courts would decide. At this moment, Mr. Fogg was sitting on a wooden bench, motionless, not angry, imperturbable. Did he think of escaping? Probably, for at one stage he walked round the room. But the door was securely locked and the window barred, so he sat down again. The custom house clock struck one. Mr. Fogg noted that his watch was 2 minutes fast. Time passed. 2 o'clock struck. If he had caught an express at that very moment, he could still have reached London and got to the Reform Club by 8:45 p.m. His brow wrinkled slightly. At 2:33, there came to his ears a din from outside, and the door was thrown open. Mrs. Oudah, Passepartout, and Inspector Fix rushed in.
"Sir, sir," gasped Fix. "Beg pardon. Most unfortunate. Mistaken identity. Real thief arrested 3 days ago. You are free."
Phileas Fogg was free. He went up to the detective and looked him straight in the eye. Then, making the only rapid move he had ever made, or would ever make in his whole life, he drew his arms back and with the precision of an automaton punched the wretched inspector with both fists.
"Well, it's..."
exclaimed Passepartout, indulging in an atrocious pun, as only a Frenchman can. He added,
"Pardieu, this is what you might call a fine English Punch and Judy."
Fogg, Oudah and Passepartout quickly left the custom house, jumped into a cab and arrived at Liverpool station a few minutes later. It was 2:40. The express had left 35 minutes previously. Fogg then ordered a special train. But, given the traffic arrangements, the special couldn't leave until 3 o'clock. Liverpool to London had to be covered in 5.5 hours. Perfectly possible if the line is clear all the way. But there were unavoidable delays, and when the train arrived at the terminus, all the clocks of London bore witness that the time was 8:50 p.m. Having completed his journey round the world, Phileas Fogg had arrived 5 minutes late. He had lost his bet. After leaving the station, Phileas Fogg had returned to his house in Savile Row with Mrs. Oudah and Passepartout, whom he instructed to go out and buy some food. He had borne the blow with his usual imperturbability. Ruined, through the fault of that bumbling police inspector. Of the substantial sum he had taken away with him, there remained only a negligible amount. His total fortune consisted of the £20,000 deposited at his bankers, Baring Brothers, and, having lost his bet, he owed this £20,000 to his colleagues at the Reform Club. After so many expenses, winning the wager would undoubtedly not have made him a rich man, but the last wager ruined him completely. He knew what he had to do. Mrs. Ouder had been given a room in the house on Savile Row. The young woman was in despair. From the few words that Mr. Fogg had uttered, she and Passepartout deduced that he was planning some fatal project. Consequently, Passepartout kept a close watch on his master. But first, the good fellow had gone up to his room and turned off the gas, which had been burning for 80 days. The night went by, hour after hour. Mr. Fogg had gone to bed, but did he sleep? Mrs. Ouder didn't get a moment's rest, and Passepartout watched like a dog outside his master's door. The following morning, Mr. Fogg called for him and told him to see to Mrs. Ouder's breakfast. Mrs. Ouder, he continued, would be so kind as to excuse him for breakfast and dinner, for all his time would be devoted to putting his affairs in order. At about 7:30, Mrs. Ouder was asked if she would receive Mr. Fogg. A few minutes later, the young woman and he were alone together in her room. Phileas Fogg sat down near the fire, opposite her. "Madam, how can you ever forgive me for bringing you to Europe?"
"Forgive you, Mr. Fogg?"
"Please allow me to finish. When the idea first came to me of taking you away from the country that had become so dangerous to you, I was a rich man and planned to place part of my fortune at your disposal. But now I am ruined."
"So, Mr. Fogg, not content with snatching me from a horrible death, you also thought yourself duty-bound to look after my position abroad?"
"Yes, madam, but events have turned against me. Still, may I request your permission to give you the little I have left?"
"But what is to become of you, Mr. Fogg?"
"Madam, I need nothing."
"But how, sir, are you going to face the future?"
"As it is fitting to do so."
"Your friends?"
"I have no friends."
"Your relatives?"
"I have no relatives left."
"Then I am truly sorry for you, Mr. Fogg, for loneliness is a sad thing."
"So they say."
"Mr. Fogg," she said, getting up and stretching out her hand, "would you wish to have someone who would be both a relative and a friend? Do you want me for your wife?"
Mr. Fogg also got up. There was an unusual light in his eyes, and his lips seemed to be almost trembling. Ouder gazed at him. The sincerity and honesty in the beautiful eyes of a noble woman astonished him at first, then penetrated his being. He shut his eyes for a moment, then opened them again.
"I love you," he said. "Yes, in truth, by everything that is most sacred in the world, I love you."
"Oh,"
sighed Ouder, placing a hand on her heart. Passepartout was rung for. Mr. Fogg was holding Mrs. Ouder's hand when he arrived. Passepartout beamed like the tropical sun at its height. Mr. Fogg asked him if it was too late to go and give notice of his matrimonial plans to the Reverend Samuel Wilson of the parish of Marylebone.
"Never too late,"
Passepartout declared.
"It'll be for tomorrow, Monday then,"
he asked. "Tomorrow? Monday?" asked Mr. Fogg, looking at Ouder.
"Yes, tomorrow, Monday," the young woman replied.
The moment has come to recount the change of opinion that had happened in Great Britain when the arrest of the real bank robber became known. He was a certain James Strand, and he was arrested in Edinburgh on the 17th of December. Till then, Phileas Fogg had been widely considered a criminal. Now he was the most honest of gentlemen. All the people who had bet for or against his winning his wager, and who had completely forgotten about it, came back to life, as if by magic, and bets began again with a new vigour. Mr. Fogg's five colleagues at the Reform Club spent the next 3 days in a state of some anxiety. Where was he? Was he perhaps dead? Had he given up the struggle?
Or was he going to appear at the door of the drawing room of the Reform Club at 8:45 p.m. on Saturday the 21st of December and win his bet? On the Saturday night in question, there was a huge crowd in Pall Mall and the surrounding streets, and as the time approached when Phileas Fogg was due to arrive, the excitement increased tremendously. That evening, the gentleman's five colleagues had assembled in the drawing room of the club. John Sullivan, Samuel Fallentin, Andrew Stewart, Gauthier Ralph, Thomas Flanagan. All were waiting anxiously. When the clock indicated 8:25, Andrew Stewart got up.
"Gentlemen, the deadline agreed between Mr. Phileas Fogg and ourselves will expire in 20 minutes. "What time did the last train from Liverpool arrive?" asked Flanagan.
7:23, replied Gauthier Ralph.
"If he'd come on the 7:23, you'd have been here by now," said Stewart. "We can therefore consider the wager won."
"Let's wait," interjected Samuel Fallentin. "Our colleague is an eccentric of the first order. His precision is well known. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he turned up at the very last moment."
"He's lost the bet," affirmed Andrew Stewart. "As you know, the China arrived yesterday, the only steamship from New York that he could have got to Liverpool. Here's a list of passengers published by the Shipping Gazette, and Phileas Fogg's name is not on it."
"All we have to do is present his cheque at Baring Brothers tomorrow," said Gauthier Ralph.
5 more minutes,
murmured Andrew Stewart, when the drawing-room clock said 8:40. One may surmise that their hearts were beating slightly faster than normal, since the stake was a big one, even for such bold gamblers. But they didn't want it to show, and adopted Samuel Fallentin's suggestion that they sit down to a rubber of whist.
8:43,
said Flanagan, glancing up at the clock before cutting the pack that Gauthier Ralph had put in front of him. The huge clubroom was quiet. The pendulum of the clock beat every second with mathematical regularity. Each of the players counted the sexagesimal units reaching his ear.
8:44,
said John Sullivan. Only a minute to go, and the bet was won. The players had laid their cards down and were counting the seconds. At the 40th second, nothing. At the 50th, still nothing. At the 55th, a sound like thunder could be heard outside. The players got to their feet. On the 57th second, the door of the drawing room opened. Before the pendulum could beat the 60th second, Mr. Phileas Fogg appeared.
"Here I am, gentlemen."
It will be recalled that at 7:55 p.m., Passepartout had been told to inform the Reverend Samuel Wilson about a certain wedding to take place the very next day. He had headed quickly for the Reverend's house, but the clergyman had not come home yet. Passepartout waited at least 20 minutes. In the end, it was 8:35 before he left the Reverend's house, running as nobody had ever run in human memory. 3 minutes later, he was back in Savile Row and staggered, completely out of breath, into Mr. Fogg's room. "What's the matter?"
"Master's wedding. Impossible."
"Impossible?"
"Impossible. Tomorrow."
"But why?"
"Tomorrow. Sunday."
"Monday," Mr. Fogg corrected him.
"No. Today. Saturday."
"Today is Saturday. Impossible."
"Yes, yes, yes,"
screamed Passepartout.
"Your calculations were a day out. We arrived 24 hours early. But now there are only 10 minutes left."
Passepartout had taken hold of his master's collar and was dragging him out with irresistible force. Phileas Fogg, not having the time to think, jumped into a cab, promised the driver £100, and reached the Reform Club after nearly running over 2 dogs and successfully hitting 5 carriages. When he appeared in the drawing room, the clock was just striking 8:45. Phileas Fogg had completed his journey around the world in 80 days and had won his bet of £20,000. How had such a meticulous man not known what day it was?
How had he come to think that he had arrived in London on the evening of Saturday the 21st of December, when it was, in fact, Friday the 20th of December? It is quite simple. Phileas Fogg had gained a day on his programme, simply because he had gone round the world eastwards. He would, on the contrary, have lost this day if he had gone in the opposite direction, namely, westwards. By heading towards the east, he had gone towards the sun, and consequently his days were 4 minutes shorter for each degree of longitude covered in that direction. Now, there are 360 degrees on the Earth's circumference, and this 360, multiplied by 4 minutes, makes exactly 24 hours. In other words, the day gained unconsciously. This means that while Phileas Fogg, heading eastwards, saw the sun cross the meridian 80 times, his colleagues in London saw it cross only 79 times. And this was why, on that very same day, Saturday, and not Sunday, as Mr. Fogg had believed, they were waiting for him in the drawing room of the Reform Club. Mr. Fogg had won his £20,000. But as he had spent about £19,000 en route, the proceeds were insignificant. Even the remaining £1,000 he split between the good Passepartout and the hapless Inspector Fix, against whom he was unable to bear a grudge. However, to keep matters straight, he charged Passepartout for the 1,920 hours of gas consumed by his gas fire through his negligence. That same evening, Mr. Fogg asked Mrs. Owder, "And does this marriage still suit you, madam?" "Mr. Fogg," she replied, "I should be asking you that question. You were ruined, and now you're rich." "Pardon me, madam, the fortune is yours. If you hadn't had the idea of getting married, my servant wouldn't have gone to the Reverend Wilson's house. I wouldn't have been told about my mistake, and..."
"Dear Mr. Fogg."
"Dear Owder." Phileas Fogg had completed his journey round the world in 80 days. He had used every means of transport: steamship, train, carriage, yacht, cargo vessel, sledge, and elephant. In all, this eccentric gentleman had displayed his marvellous qualities of composure and precision. But what was the point? What had he got out of his journey? "Nothing," comes the reply. "Nothing. Agreed. Apart from a lovely wife, who, however unlikely it may seem, made him the happiest of men. In truth, wouldn't anyone go round the world for less?"